I fed stuff to Jim. We had got our names out there so much as editors and stuff, one way or another, that this was stuff that had rolled into me from leftover strokes, from mucked, you know, sort of, oh, well, here's someone you can send your stuff to that I'd saved.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent it on to Jim. Okay. And then it found its way to Jenny, because Jenny did edit this.
Okay.
Jenny Collins really did edit this. And that's all my role was?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Jim gathered some of the poems. He had a batch of them. I sent him some stuff, and he gave it to Jenny. And she did it.
Wow. Okay. I had an interview with Jenny, but my car lost a tire, and I missed it. So her bit of the story is going to get left out, unfortunately.
Whoa.
Maybe I didn't realize that she played quite that role.
She had a pretty significant role in this. Yep.
Wow.
I can't remember how Boyd Card's art got in there.
It's wonderful, though.
I must have sent that on, or I put him up to it one way or the other. Jim would have asked for Dick Hague stuff. Buzzsaws in the Rain is a neat piece.
Yeah.
I love that piece.
So how's the tone of this Pine Mountain, Sand and Gravel, and the other two, which seem to follow the same tone? Now, is this you here?
That's me.
Okay, that's what I thought.
That's Gail Amberg.
Oh, huh, okay.
And this is taken in Whitesburg, Kentucky, down there at the Malted Cabbage.
It's pretty nice
photo.
Yeah, it's pretty good. The Malted Cabbage. I didn't realize that. There it is, Malted Cabbage, but...
Yuck.
How is this a continuation of the co-op connections? What kind of group of writers is represented in Thoughts?
I tell you, I think this issue reflects a little, somewhat. It's got Jenny's flavor in there. Jenny's a sweetheart, and it's got somewhat more feminine, somewhat softer flavor to it. Of course, the first time it doesn't. That mine doesn't. That Truth Will Make You Whole.
Yeah,
is a kind of a St. Jude type piece, but some of the others in there are rather relatively soft. Now this one, which one is this?
That's number two.
Now number two has Jenny's name. It doesn't have my name on it, does it?
No.
Let me see this one. Much bigger involvement on this one. If I remember rightly on this one, I love to try to buy decent shoes.
Yeah.
Good piece.
My favorite piece in this one is Mexican Standoff.
Snyder's?
Yeah, I think that is a tremendous poem.
It is.
And that's right out of the beat. It has that sort of beat, rhythm, and sound to it. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
It's one that just comes right out of the mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I have to say this. I don't specifically remember how much my involvement was in this. I know that... I'm going to tell this on Jim. Jim has been pretty much perpetually disorganized with regards to gathering work together and or responding to writers that submitted.
Yeah, I know.
So it's basically fallen to me to really gather and hold the stuff and make sure it didn't get lost to some extent or other. That was probably, throughout these, my role as much as anybody's was to sort of keep the stuff in one folder,
mm-hmm.
if you will. And even then, a considerable amount went directly to Jim, as I'm sure been lost by the wayside. And you can probably find a lot of disgruntled writers out there that tell you that.
I was one of them back when I first read this. I sent some stuff in and never heard of it since. So
that's unfortunate. And even our last Pine Mountain Sand and Gravel, the gray one that came out, which is probably the most handsome and nicest, you know, there's a boxes of them languishing at Apple Shop and in Jim's house, where we literally even have not responded to orders that have been sent. It's really bad. I mean, it's sad because
Jim just got so busy with the radio station, and then we spent the most money, and this is the prettiest book.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book
we ever did, and I really love it. I mean, I love to hold it, and it just has. We just simply didn't get it out in the way we should have. Jim has in many ways. Well, I feel frustration about Jim. I feel frustration because Jim's written some of the best Appalachian stuff that's ever been done. Get In Jesus comes to mind. Three or four others that he's done. I mean, Jim is an incredibly good poet who rarely writes and has written even less since he's become involved with WMMT. And I mean, he knows, I would say this even sitting here, and I've talked to him about it many times, saying, Jim, you know, the radio station's great, but you know, what about your life as a writer? Your lifeblood is seeping away and you're not doing anything. You know, and there was a point in Jim's life where his drive to write was much greater than it is now. And I feel lost for Jim and for the region that way. Organizationally, whenever Jim and I's relationship with regards to Mutt, Strokes, which he helped with, and all the Pine Mountain Sand and Gravels, it felt Jim had gotten a lot of money from his brother, he probably told you that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a critical piece of the puzzle. And we worked together. But I think the push and the organization in it fell a little more to me. And I'm not the best at it, but I'm better than Jim. And he probably said that too. I don't know if he did or not.
He bewailed himself. He did not hail you. Though.
Well, I don't mean to hail myself.
Yeah.
I just tried to pick up the slack when I could.
Mm-hmm.
It's about how probably a better way to put that. Because I didn't do any great big bang up job of it either. And I think the whole editing process, when you got people submitting and stuff like that, is pretty haphazard and slipshod at times anyway. But so one of these books. And I swear, it's not the one that my name is on. I did a hell of a lot of editing in it, but I can't remember which one. I really can't. One of them I just did a hell of a lot of work on. And what I think happened there was that I must have culled a lot of the work, a huge pile of stuff down to a good pile, and then I think it must have got passed to Jenny.
Uh-huh.
That's probably how when she did the final edit, I think. I couldn't swear to that.
That's as good a version as I've heard yet. And that's all that we're running on.
Yeah, I mean, that could be completely wrong. I just have it in my mind. One of the Pine Mountains in Sand and Gravel came out did not have my name on it. And I know I did. I knew I had done a shitload of work on it. I just can't remember which one.
Let's get theoretical. I've got lots of ideas about magazines and about writer communities. And one of these ideas is that a work along with its companion pieces, along with its brothers and sisters, so to speak, grows up amongst those brothers and sisters. That standing alone is not an accurate measure or understanding of a piece of work as it is with its peers,
mm-hmm.
as it is with the things which right. bring it to talk to itself, bring it to hold itself responsible for itself, and allow a dialogue to go on between the pieces.
I like that.
Does that make sense to you?
That's perfect sense.
That's the heart of a magazine and of a group of writers producing a piece like this?
Well, I think that's right. Actually, if you look at the continuum, you look at the first New Ground as being the first salvo, a little rough, a little naive, but very open. Then you look at a political happening that occurred and was sort of taking the best of the political stuff from, or the best of the political ideas from New Ground. In a scene, an event that had happened, a flood,
mm-hmm.
In the heart of the Appalachian coal fields and doing mucked. Then, okay, so you've done a real political thing. Then you come back later and you say, well, let's do something completely different. We've done that, now let's do something different. Okay, let's do a rowdy sexual thing. I mean, you know, there's some stuff in there in Strokes, like Jim Wayne Miller's poem, A Rationale for Lovers, right? Which, you know, the women hated, and it's a sleazy, awful. I mean, I literally wrote Jim and said, send me something no one else will print.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, and I printed it. I mean, the idea of it was just simply, well, let's not get pigeonholed. Let's not get
locked in.
Is
that the one where you have the pornography, the beginning?
Tropical porno poem for Nita
yes,
Bryant?
Yes, uh-huh.
Right. So, you know, it had all that stuff in it. Well, then we did that thing. Then the anthologies, of course, cooking along. And it would have been the most solid. It would have been the most commercial. And solid and commercial, which is kind of an interesting mix. But that book was the most viable product that was ever produced, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it never came out.
I mean, so you could say that was the child that never got born, but if you were thinking about it in terms of how we were operating, it was there. I mean, we never came to fruition. Well, we thought it was going to come to fruition for 3 years before we found out it wouldn't. Then Pine Mountain Gravel starts to stir. Well, Pine Mountain is a function of one, need to do another book, and also, you know, Jim had done Rec, which I'm sure he talked to you about. But Jim always liked to do books. What we're talking about doing now, and I really haven't met with Jim, we need to, is, you know, do the next book, next Pine Mountain we talked about doing was doing all the censored work. We were going to take excerpts from my play. We were going to get the gay stuff from Pat. We were going to do the story that the Humanities Foundation killed of Georgia Alliance. And we were going to throw out this stuff to everybody. And then we were going to say, everybody, give us the work that you yourself are not sure of. Not sort of rationale for rubbers, but the work that you yourself are not really sure if this is what you want to say or if it's the right thing to say or... You know,
something that you're on the edge of.
That you yourself feel is on the edge. And let's put that in a book and see what that means. So every book has had its own motif, its own place. I like the siblings thing that you got. I think that's the best metaphor. You know, I couldn't come up with one better than that. I couldn't even come close. I like the idea that the children are shaped by their position in the family.
Yeah.
I think that's real accurate. What the future would hold... I still think Gurney's on the cutting edge of it. His new crazy quilt, actually his piece in this Pine Mountain Sand and Gravel.
The Lance Olson interview.
Well, the interview's okay, and I like it okay. I think it's a finger-cracking kind of interview, but I like his short story. Is this one?
That's number two.
Number two,
Stargate.
Oh, well, what can you say about that piece? That piece is modern Appalachia. That's where we're going. That's where we are. Actually, it's where we've been for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we're now getting around to saying it. But even now when we say it, Crazy Quilt was very much in that mode. But we're still being blocked, bottlenecked, thwarted by people who define Appalachia in different ways or other ways, people that are in power. But that's what it is. Appalachians have been to town. I mean, most of us really have been to town now. We've been to California. We've been to New York. There are a number of people around like Gurney. Gurney's a Kentuckian. He's an Appalachian. But he's also part Californian. He's part New World, New Age. I'm a New York boy that had some roots in Appalachia, that lived in California, that's lived in Colorado, New Mexico, Kentucky, and West Virginia. That tends to be the rule more now than anything else. And even those that are born and bred and been in the holler and come up the tough way have been to the UK and hung out for 10 years and, you know, worked at IBM or... I mean, it's a real... That, to me, is the true spot of where we're at now. And that's what excites me. And that's what excited me about writing Crazy Quilt, was writing a piece that was very, very modern.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to do. You know, I think we had a period where we needed to do the hound dog thing. We needed to do the grandma in the rocking chair thing. We needed to do the black culture, the Appalachian culture thing, which was equivalent to, you know, Appalachia's beautiful. Hillbilly's beautiful. Mm-hmm. We needed to do that. We had to do that. And that happened. And then, you know, we maybe went a little overboard with it. And then now the flip side is this hillbilly grotesque stuff I'm telling you about, which is sort of mining the stereotype in a new way. And that's very disturbing to me. It's got a real slick modern patina to it. It's got the same virulent kind of stereotyping, but it's done in such a smooth way, very palatable to the larger culture. That's what really bothers. It's like the beans of Egypt.
I don't know that.
Okay, it's a book written about a family up in Maine. It's real popular about 3 or 4 years ago and real negative in a way. I mean, it has some elements of truth. I'm not saying it doesn't. It's just that it's a kind of imbalanced piece. And that disturbs me. I still want to, and, you know, Steve Fesmeyer, the film person over here at the West Virginia Library Commission, has always said, as a critique of Apple Shop's films, when are they going to do something on the Appalachian middle class? Good point. And that's virtually uncharted territory for most of us. Now, there have been some novelists that have gotten onto it.
Because, I mean, what is the Appalachian middle class? It's the middle class of America, almost.
Well, it is. It is. It's got some Appalachian flavor to it. I mean, for me,
That's been a tough question to answer. I never have come up with a satisfactory answer for myself. I guess what I've always sort of said is, gee, I'm more interested in men that have black lung and end up at a black lung coal mining meeting and say something that stunned you. I mean, it's hard to get worked up about middle class culture.
Yeah, but that's where we are. That's I deeply identify with this crisis because it's the crisis that I have for myself, from the middle class, but with no voice, with complete silence,
yeah.
With complete unknowledge of what being middle class means. And that's the plight of the middle class itself.
Yeah, well, see, for me, you know, if you go back in my life, I was born into Levittown has real significant meaning in terms of my being an Appalachian writer, interestingly enough, because Levittown was the great granddaddy of subdivisions. It was as middle class, it was lower middle class, but it was as middle class as you can possibly get. Okay, and it was everybody bailing out of New York City and going out to potato fields that were turned into houses,
mm-hmm.
Right? I remember growing up, it was the first malls where now Nassau County, the county I was raised in, is nothing but malls and houses, and has been for 20 years. I mean, 50 years ago, it was nothing but potato fields. And that pattern has been mimicked and followed throughout the nation now. In Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley, I mean, to Denver, you just go on and on, the list is endless. And I remember, seriously do remember when I was growing up, I mean, I was lucky. I got to sort of experience Appalachian culture and get to know that and feel good about it before I knew, basically, that I was a totally rootless person. And when I came to that realization in my life, it happened to me around age 16 and 17. My parents were divorced. The hippie thing was happening big time in New York. The Vietnam culture was going on. I mean, I looked around in Long Island and I just said, I hate this.
I belong to a Rice Krispie box.
This is awful. This is just awful, right? And at that point, I came to West Virginia. I mean, not just physically came, but mentally. I said, I've got to find something. I mean, I needed that in my life. I'm a very lucky person. I own my grandparents' old home place in West Virginia. Right? I've been in it my whole life. You know, I can go in that house and I can remember looking up at the staircase gloves upstairs, you know, and have that, and remember what it looked like when I was 2 years old and how high it was. Right? I can step out and see the mountains, those ridges that were first in my mouth. I mean, I know that's just, it's just home plate to me, and I'm a very lucky man to have it. I don't know what would have happened to me in my life if I hadn't had it, because I feel, continue to feel, at times completely alienated from American life, truly disturbed by my participation in this culture. And all I really want to do is go back up on that mountain and live. That's the God's honest truth. I mean, I could just very easily check out. I really could.
Yeah.
And it's just a function of being weary, of being tired of being a consumer. So anyway, probably part of the reason why I am an Appalachian writer, and I don't know what Appalachia, if they ever want to deal with me as a writer, will say or do with me. I mean, Gurney and Georgella and Joe Carson and Ann Shelby and others have moved on fine with Orchard Books. I, too, have sent stuff to Jackson, and he does not like my stuff. I think to a certain extent I've been probably penalized for not being a native Appalachian. I'm not sure how exactly that's gone. It hasn't mattered to people like Jim Webb or others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think many people sort of look at my work and I hope the work stands or falls by itself as to whether the flavor of Appalachia is there or not. I mean, I've tried. And it hasn't... I mean, I'm so much like my daddy. I mean, I look like my daddy. I think like my daddy. I mean, my dad has had such a profound influence on me that really, I mean, I know I wasn't born and raised a culture. I'm not going to try to pass myself off as a native, but I've just been so influenced by my dad and my Baber roots that not only have I been influenced by them, but I've reached for them.
Mm-hmm.
I've strove to immerse myself in that world.
Tell me about the Baber Mountain poetry meetings. That I've occasionally run across and heard rumor of.
Oh, they've been great. We've had everything from ecstasies to fistfights, you know, and everything in between. And we've had wonderful readings, and there's been no grant money involved, and everybody could say and do just exactly what they pleased. We've had people take all their clothes off, and they've mellowed out over the last 4 to 5 years as people have gotten older and showed up with kids. And,
you have to wander out in the forest.
Tends to keep the lid on.
Yeah,
they've been great. I've really enjoyed doing the Baber Mountain thing. I don't think there's anything else quite like them that happens in the mountains, really. The readings themselves have been, some of the readings have been absolutely stunning. I mean, the diversity of the work we've had. Mm-hmm. And it's something I've enjoyed doing, really. Jim's been a wonderful supportive help to that. You know, it's been as much Jim's time as it's been mine, really. And we've named it together. You know, that's been an evolution, first from the first one, which was just the sock meeting.
Mm-hmm.
We did one early sock meeting there. Actually, I think it was one of the first ones that started off the Witter-Beiner project. And as I say, it is way up in the high country. This was a late spring meeting. It might have been late April. And everybody came up. We had a wonderful Saturday event. Woke up Sunday morning. There was like 8 inches of snow on the ground and pounding it down. You know, and everybody had to get out, put chains on Snyder's. Gurney Norman put chains on Snyder's car, his old, whatever it was, Rambler or something. Everybody had to get out of the mountain, you know, before it got deeper. And then they all drove back out of the mountains down into there. And by the time they got to Charleston, I'm sure there wasn't, you know, or even 30, 40 miles down the road, there wasn't a flake of snow. So it was, there'd been been a series of incredible storms. So that's part of how the name evolved. First, we started out with the poetry reading.
Uh-huh.
Then Jim and I got this poultry thing going, you know, as a little joke, making fun of ourselves. And then it was the Baber Mountain poultry reading. And then, of course, I always, there's ramps, you know, those leaks.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a whole mountainside of them, and Richwood's sort of one of the ramp capitals of West Virginia and of Appalachia. So we had the Baber Mountain poultry reading and ramp feed. And then Jim added the swarp, which was party.
Yeah.
And then of late, it's been the Baber Mountain poultry reading, ramp feed, ionization. The ionization came from, we had 4 years running where we had the absolute most intense summer storms. I mean, it is high up in the mountains, but, and you get big storms in the summer when it's hot, but we had some storms that came through there that were just incredible. The last one of which was so intense that the house got struck twice by lightning.
Good Lord.
Electricity got, I mean, fire bolts coming through the house. Scared to live in shit. I mean, I've been seeing some intense storms up there. It didn't do me that day, but people who aren't used to it, you know, were just like freaked. It was so loud. The storm was so intense. We were in the house with all the doors shut, and we had to forego the reading. You couldn't hear. The wind beating and the rain against the house, and the electric was knocked out and never did come back. We had candles through the whole house. And everybody got drunk.
Oh, God.
So that's how we ended up with the Baber Mountain poultry reading, ramp feed, ionization, and swarp. I think I've got a new edition too. I was going to add on, but I can't remember what it is at the moment.
So that's, yeah, we'll come back to you.
Right. So, you know, it's those have been fun. They've been fun. They said they've had a lot to do with the soup beans and the sock and all that kind of stuff. Just an opportunity, intentionally written without any, done on a low budget, maybe $150, just sort of, uh-huh, you know, pitching for a keg and buy some hamburgers or some salads and not get any grant money, so you don't owe anybody anything. And so you can, and there's always been a sort of Dionysian flavor to them, because there's nothing else around the farm. So you, once people get up there, they really sort of have a tendency to just. And I think it's been healthy for us to do that. You know, I'm getting a little weary of them. I don't know how much. Every year it's over, I sort of shake my head and go, oh, I don't know. You know, but then every year rolls around and I can't say, oh, we won't. You know.
Yeah, I have New Year's parties like that. Once you invite me, you're maybe I'll come. I don't know if you would want to.
Well, tell me about it.
Just the most, everything that anybody has ever wanted to do has been carried through and done from orgies, which is something that everybody always held as an ideal and discovered was an awful thing.
Really?
Yeah, everybody was, you know, was sharing your sexuality with all the people who you love and care deeply about, but who, nonetheless, you don't usually cross that border with, and who had just stressed everybody out beyond the, you know, limit to just sheer craziness and destruction and fun and loving. You know, they're great things. They're absolutely wonderful, because it's the only time that all the group of people I know get back together, but nonetheless, when they're over, I'm glad it's over.
I tend to be like an old acid trip. Tend to be rather draining.
Yeah,
you're kind of glad when they're over and you're like, you say, I don't know, I don't think I'm going to do that anymore. You know, that's how I was at the end of acid trips, you know, just,
God.
It felt like an electric socket that's had 15 plugs in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
God, just get this stuff off of me and let me lay down in bed. Yeah, listen to my head roar. Right, right.
I don't know. Let's see, the Baber Mountain readings, I think if I quit them, I think they gave him up, that they, I don't know, I'd say I'd like to change him, really, is what I'd like to do. I'm to the point now where I would like to get a stage.
Mm-hmm.
Move them away from the house. They always end up in the house, and the house always gets trashed. Real hard on the house. Real hard to clean the house up. Dang, we had so many bad storms, everybody had to get in the house.
Yeah.
You know, literally. I mean, when you get 75 people in a house, you know, it's just
tends to be, no matter what happens, yeah.
Yeah, it's just hard on a house. I mean, you know, you get cigarette butts out and wine spilled, and, you know, and then and everybody splits, and you got to clean it up, and it's a pain in the ass. And you're exhausted, hung over yourself. And you don't want to do it. So, I don't know. I'm thinking, you know, at some point I'd like to maybe get, and I'd like to sort of turn it more into a fest atmosphere where poetry was still the focus, but where we might have music and art. And we sort of have always had some elements of art and music.
Yeah.
Some of the musicians have showed up, and there's always been some banjo pickers and artists and this and that, but I don't know. You know, I've had a lot of ideas about Paper Mountain. I don't know what's going to come of them. I've thought about starting a Paper Mountain Institute, which would be sort of a rural retreat with one central house and a series of cabins scattered around the mountain where people could come paint, do various workshops, writing, painting, psychology, touchy-feely stuff. I mean, it could be anything, environmental, uh-huh. Whatever. That's an idea that's always been in the back of my head to do. I don't know if that'll come to pass or not. It's a kind of a lifetime thing I've thought about, sort of on the Highlander model. In a way.
Yeah.
Only this one would be more of an artist calling
mm-hmm.
situation, and where you would have a central clearing place for everybody to come together, but also everybody to disperse and do their thing. And then I would throw some California stuff in there too, like bike trails, cross country ski trails, hot tubs.
Yeah.
Make it a sort of resort institute where people could really get away.
Mm-hmm.
And have the, because it really is a pretty pristine, very rural. I mean, there's nothing. You're up on top of my mountain, you can see for 50 miles, and you can't see anything but trees. Wherever you look,
wow,
it is that rural. So, and I've always thought it would be neat for people to be able to see that part of Appalachia, which rarely gets seen. Really.
Yeah.
People are too busy being on the interstates and the roads to ever see the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
The real mountains, the high, high Appalachian mountains, you know, and all their beauty and splendor, which I love. You know, I love when I'm up on my farm. I mean, that's what I love the best. And it would make me happy to just go there right now and spend the rest of my life writing. That's what I'd like to do. I don't really want to be an arts administrator, but I have a choice in there to write.
Yeah.
And it's not bad work. I mean, I've painted houses, I've dug ditches, I've done a lot of that kind of stuff. I shouldn't bitch. Really, I shouldn't. The money's better where I'm getting now too. But and the work, I mean, you know, you're facilitating other artists, you're renovating theaters, there's good stuff happening. But I worry about all ideas and things. You know, I got a novel I'd like to write about the farmhouse. I really would like to write a book called The Dreams and Recollections of Kindred Spirits,
mm-hmm.
which would be a sort of story of that particular farmhouse. And it'd be a story of its being cut from the wilderness and a family being raised up in the Depression and World War II and how they dispersed and about a hippie that comes back there and beats the black snakes out of it and goes through a divorce and finally ends up there, and kind of 100 years of American history done from the point of view of an Appalachian mountain farmhouse.
Sounds wonderful.
You know, I'd like to do that. And I got about 3 or 4 children's books I'd like to do, and I'd like to do 2 or 3 collections of Locus with some illustrations by Boyd Carr. It would be real sort of modern Basho type
mm-hmm.
American something or others. So those are some of the gigs I'd like to do, and you know, I mean, I might get around to them, but I just worry that, you know, something can happen to me, or I won't get the time to do it. But
what can you do?
You know, you can't. You just got to survive. So
yeah,
you know, and that's a perennial problem for writers. If West Virginia had a more supportive atmosphere for the arts, or if WVU would print writers, West Virginia writers, which they haven't. As the University of New Mexico does. Now, Kentucky's been an asshole press, too. But things might have gone a little better for me in my life. I might have had an opportunity to... I mean, I could very easily have 6 or 7 or 8 books under my belt right now. Instead, I only have one sort of homegrown one of 76, Lifesavers. And so a lot of stuff has not made it out into the world. You know, there was a period where I went through big-time fretting over that. I'm not that fretful about it anymore. I sort of feel like, well, if the work's got value,
maybe sooner or later I'll get out of there. That might not be true, but that's what I say to live with it, you know.
So let's talk about Appalachian connections and literature connections, and because it's something that drives me mad and crazy, thinking about that other world of writing, which is a world of production and a world of connections and a world of who you know and a world of influence, yeah, versus a world of, to me, truth, honesty, and integrity on the other side. And